Okay, we first of all want to welcome the Deaners from Atlanta, Amos and Charles. Probably a little early, but say Shem Shalom. They're going back to Chutz Laaretz tonight. So a safe trip back. So there are very few scenes in the entire Sefer Bereishis that are as dramatic and as iconic as that quiet, dark, lonely moment where Yaakov dreams and envisions a ladder. Remember, we all know the end of Vayetze. We all know that Yaakov will return triumphant, familied, four wives, wealthy. As far as he knows, he's disappearing into an abyss and no one will hear from him again. He's been expelled by his family, stalked by his brother, he's penniless, he's alone. And he dreams of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that dream is pivoted on a ladder. And he wakes up and he's ecstatic because HaKadosh Baruch Hu has verified. Remember, this is the first time HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicates with Yaakov. So you had to have lived with some uncertainty. Was it morally correct of me to take the brachos? Hashem never came down to Yaakov and said, he did a good job, I'm proud of you. I know it was tough, I know you had some moral qualms about it, but don't worry, we're okay. You're on the right side. Nothing. His father never says that to him. Remember, as far as his father's concerned, Yaakov's off to get married. Rivka obscures the fact that Esau's trying to murder Yaakov. So Yitzchak never huddles with Yaakov and says, your brother Esau's trying to murder you, you got to run. So Yaakov's living in this world of uncertainty. No one has validated or ratified anything in Parshas Toldos. Now Kadosh Baruch Hu, the ladder, the malachim, it's pretty clear. He gets the brachos, chol hayam, afar aretz, not really chol hayam, afar aretz. It's pretty clear now that he's the zera nifcha, he's the chosen. All this maneuvering and all this choreographing of toldos makes sense. It works. Like HaKadosh Baruch Hu ratifies it. And he wakes up and there's a real religious moment. He sees things clearly. He's passionate. Let's read these psukim. Vayikatz Yaakov Mishnasa, fourth source. Vayomer Achein. There's a recognition. There's a revelation. Yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh v'anochi lo yadati. It's not just about Hashem's presence in a place. It's Hashem's presence in His place. Hashem cares about me. Hashem is revealing Himself to me. Achein. Yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh. Where I am, Hashem is. It's ratifying of His past and it's promising of His future. That even though He has to be stripped from Eretz Yisrael, wherever He goes, Hashem, Yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh. Vayirah vayomar manara makom hazeh. And that revelation yields Yirah Shemayim. Remember, Har HaMoriah is the site in Sefer Bereishis of Yirah Shemayim. What does the Kadosh Baruch Hu tell Avram through the Malach and Parshas Vayera? Ata yadati, kirei elokim ata. You proved to me you are Ohev Hashem, but now can you encounter me and realize how distant you are from me, how little you know about me? And Yaakov sees Hashem, feels Hashem's presence, gets Hashem's promises, but ma nora, nora elokim mimikdashecha. Part of our relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu is trying to understand Him, trying to reconcile His will, trying to synchronize His will with our will, but we all get to the point where we realize ki lo machshevosai machshevosechem v'lo darchechem derachayinu Hashem. We don't understand Him, and that's called Yirah Shamayim. We just submit to the mystery that I'll never understand. I submit. Yirah Shamayim is not fear. Yirah Shamayim is not panic. Yirah Shamayim is not fright. It's submission. Recognition of distance and difference. And the acceptance of that hierarchy that's a product of that distance. So, manara makom hazeh, ein zeh kiyem beis elokim v'zeh shara shamayim. Wow, these are probably two of the most powerful phrases in all of Bereishis. Beis elokim, shara shamayim. When you're standing at the Kotel and you're trying to think about these phrases from Tanakh that stream through your mind, these have got to be the top of the list. Beis Elokim, Shara Shamayim. There's Svarim named after. Beis Elokim, Shara. Who wouldn't want to live in the Beis Elokim, Shara Shamayim? It's a moment of vision, of prophecy, of religious ecstasy, religious euphoria. So he builds a mizbech. Vayashkim Yaakov b'boker v'yikach z'aven asher samir asher sal v'yasem esam matzei v'yishak shemen. He brings a carbon Israel of animals, but it's the best he can do. Vayikshem akom beisel. He names it as a house of Hashem. Is it Yerushalayim? Is it beisel? Is it some combination? The geography is all off in the beginning of Vayetze. We don't really know where he is. Is he in Haran? Is he in beisel? Is he in Yerushalayim? To remind us that he really doesn't have geography. He's someone without a home. He's without place and without grounds, but it doesn't make a difference because If you have a Kodesh Baruch Hu in a relationship, you always have geography. That's why Hashem is referred to as Makom in Vayetz. Hashem is the Makom. You don't need to have a Makom. Hashem is the Makom of our Makom. We live in Elanshvet, you live in Atlanta, they live in Hashem. Hashem is the presence of those Makoms, the same way that we live in our Makom. So if you have that relationship with Kodesh Baruch Hu, it doesn't make a difference if you're in Beit El or Luz or Yushalayim or Haran or Beis El. The coordinates don't make a difference. These are all really soaring, surpassing psukim. Then it all hits a thud. Then it all hits a rut. Then the whole parsha changes. I mean, these are psukim of... Yaakov should say Hallel. Yaakov should start singing. Yaakov should lock it. And then all of a sudden, all this poetry and passion and vision and prophecy becomes a contract. Yidar Yaakov neder lemor. Yaakov tells Hashem. Hashem, I'm going to paraphrase Yaakov's offer to Hashem. You take care of me. You protect me. You feed me. You clothe me. You transport me back. You know what, Hashem? I'll cut you in 10%. We're business partners. What's on you? The food, the clothing, and the safe passage. What's on me? I'll give you 10%. What is he doing? Who invited the lawyers? This is Har Moriah. This is the single greatest icon of Sefer Bereishis. And you're bringing in the lawyers and signing the contract? Karbanos, Matseva, Shemen, all of a sudden, Vayidar, Neter, Im Yelo, Kimi, Madi, Shmani, Bederach, Hazer, Shanochi, Olech, Venasali, Lechem, Lechol, Vegel, Lubosh, Veshavti, Mishalom, Obey, Savi, Vayashem, Lin, Lokim. These are the conditions, Hashem. For heaven is us, I'm coming back to this place. And this time I'll be packing great wealth and I'll give you 10% of whatever I earn. It's such a shift. It's such a thematic non sequitur. The first part is just so triumphant and so poetic and so prophetic, and now it's so pedestrian and mundane and contracts, and that's what you do when you're facing HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Say Hallel, Shira. What is happening to Yaakov? What divik possesses him that all of a sudden he goes all legal and makes legal commitments and contracts with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? The answer, as you probably guessed, I should be recording this. The answer, as you probably guessed, I am recording. The answer, as you probably guessed, is at the core of how we experience our lives, and in particular, how we experience yeshiva as one example of moments of clarity. So we like to talk a lot in this room about life, not just challenges we face 18-19, but challenges we face throughout our lives. But this is a challenge throughout our lives, which is even more acute the next 1 or 2 years in your life. What is a yeshiva? What's a metaphor for yeshiva? I was trying to find metaphors. Metaphors remind us of the crossover effect in life, that we can compare our experience to something else, and all of a sudden it makes sense because we're familiar with that other experience. So what does it mean to be in yeshiva? What metaphor would you apply to yeshiva? So some have said, and I understand part of it, but some of it rubs me the wrong way, I find some of it too strident and too abrasive. Some have said, especially in the context of Sefer Bereishis, that a yeshiva is like a teva, is like an ark. The world outside is chaotic. It is. The world outside is violent. It is. The world outside is dangerous religiously. It is. The world outside is immoral. It is. The yeshiva is a sane, quiet, tranquil, moral, idealistic location. And there are parts of yeshiva that are like that teva. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. Parts of yeshiva require that recognition that this is a different set of standards. As much as we don't want to disassociate, it's still a different world. And there are values here that aren't as powerfully and passionately expressed. You leave yeshiva, you realize that a little bit, and you appreciate it a little bit more. But I find that metaphor troubling on two fronts. First of all, because it's very, very exclusionary. Because the teva, by definition, is an exclusionary experience. Everyone who's in the teva survives. Everyone who's outside of the teva drowns, and quite frankly, we want them to drown. They deserve to drown. Noach isn't throwing any lifeboats. Noach's not throwing any life rafts. Not throwing any tubes out for people to hang on. Og is hanging on, according to Chazal Basel. And is that the way we view yeshiva? That those who are in are redeemed, and those who are out are condemned, and those who are in are good, and those who are out are evil, and those who are... Is that my version of yeshiva? There are some strains of that. part of what I felt, again, it's very different in different locations, but I went to a more of a yeshivish high school, far, far more than any of those that you would be familiar with. And part of what rankled me when I left, nothing bad about it, but I felt like it wasn't reflective of my neshama, is there was a sense of yeshiva bachrim and Torah learners. They are the center of the universe, and they are. But if you're not yeshiva, there was no way to integrate them, to acknowledge them, to ratify. Words such as oisvarf and meaningless and people that had no place. And I just, Rav Lichtenstein would tell us that he felt that this was part of a century-long process in trying to build the prestige of yeshiva bachrim. See, after World War I, the status of yeshiva bachrim plummeted. My great-grandfather lived this whole process on his skin. World War I led to a worldwide financial collapse. And Jews were always at the bottom of the food chain. And Jews in Eastern Europe were at the bottom of the food chain. Western European Jews were more wealthy than their Eastern European counterparts. My great-grandfather got married around the time pre-World War I, and being a budding, promising Talmud Chacham, he was promised to be supported by his wife's family so he could learn his whole life. And then World War I struck, and the whole system collapsed, and all those financial promises were meaningless, and he spent his life not really having gainful employment and gainful sustenance. And again, I didn't meet him that much. I was very young, but I heard stories about him. And the stock in the status of yeshiva bachrim declined. Oh, yeshiva bachrim, you're just parasites. Yeshiva bachrim, you're just living off of other people. We're struggling to get by, and you guys have been promised great riches and wealth. So Rav Lichtenstein told us that he felt that in the 1920s and 30s and 40s in Europe, and then after the war in America, there was an attempt to compensate and to rebuild the stature of a yeshiva bachur. And the yeshiva bachur was learning Torah and saving the world. Ideas we believe in. Everyone in this room believes in those ideas. Anyone thinks that only soldiers are protecting our country? Have you been paying attention to the war? Have you been paying attention to the missiles? Of course, boys that are sitting and learning Yom HaValayla are contributing in great, great fashion to the defense of our country and the improvement of our Mishra. But he felt like the stress of exclusiveness, that those who are in have meaning, and those who are out are basically wasting their time. They're just straw figures. And somehow that Teva metaphor can create exclusivity. In, out, us, them, good, bad, insiders, outsiders. That's what I find difficult. A Hesder Yeshiva is predicated on the notion that somehow we have to be a vanguard, and we have to learn with all of our might and try to bring Kedusha to our people and spread Torah and serve them on that behalf. And so yeshiva is predicated on the antithesis of us versus them. It's us and them. Not even them, it's us and us. Part of the difference living in America and living in Eretz Yisrael, living in Chutz La'aretz, living in America. In America, it's us and them. The question that people have is, and you have to build a wall. Everyone's got to build a wall. The question is how high the wall should be and how many windows there should be. Some people feel that wall should be towering and admit nothing from the foreign culture and create a real divide and no windows. Some people feel no windows, filter, integration. I'm not discussing that issue here, but don't fool yourself. Jews are meant to be different. How different? How demarcated should those differ? Those are all legitimate questions. But as you saw, the us's are them. The thems are us. There's no thems. If there's crime in Haifa, if there's prostitution in Be'er Sheva, if there's psychological, it's all us, it's all our family, it's all our people. And that's one issue about the Teva I find a little bit unsettling. Second Teva issue is, and this is what I want to speak about tonight, is Nach leaves the Teva and there is no residue of the Teva. The Teva doesn't influence his life. He uses it for firewood, that's about it. He uses it to build some bows on which to plant the wine that unfortunately torpedoes his future. That's all. There's no lessons from the Teva. It's a 12-month hiatus. It's a 12-month shelter, 12-month fortress of solitude. He's immunized against the elements. Then he walks out of the Teva. And we're working so hard. Everyone should be working. How does this carry over? How does this carry over? How can my experiences in yeshiva, whatever they are, learning, davening, midos, how will it affect me? I mean, if you haven't asked these questions, it's probably about time you start asking questions. For example, a question I'm not going to answer, I'm just going to dangle it to get your attention. You all read Ritva's today, probably. Do you think you're going to be reading a Ritva in 20 years when you learn Torah? Probably not. I'd cut my right arm off now if I knew that everyone in this room would go through Daf Yomi every day of their life and go to Minyan. So why are we spending so much time teaching you Ritvas and so much time teaching you Rashbas? Some of you will pursue that, but most of you won't. I told you, we're this entire dance, this entire pomp and sasa is to get you to learn Torah, Bikuvet and the Torah, for which most of you will be Bikis. So, important question. Other questions. How can I work on Minyan? I've said this so often, I want to sound like a broken record. Running and catching a Minyan in Yishuv is not building Minyan muscles. It's just checking off a box. Okay, I checked off a box. I did Minyan B'tzibur. This is the year to build Minyan muscles, to know how to muscle memory, how to go to Minyan, how to condition yourself to get up and be part of a community, be part of a healthy. So you got to ask yourself, what decisions am I taking this year? Well, Teva doesn't carry over. So I don't think the Teva captures it. I think it captures an element of it, unique values, sane values, protection, tranquility, but I don't think it captures it. What I think does capture it is a very different metaphor. It's what I talk about tonight, and then we'll see how I think Yaakov is living this experience. If you ask me to describe yeshiva, well, it's on your cheat sheet, I would call yeshiva a lighthouse. Why is the yeshiva a lighthouse? What happens in the lighthouse? In the lighthouse, the captain and the navigators and the sailors convene in moments of serenity and calm, clear-headedness, clarity, lucidity, everything's clear, weather's calm, they're protected from the elements, and they navigate their path. And they set a course. And they say, in 2 days' time, after X nautical clicks, however, we'll turn the rudder left a little for 3 degrees. And then after 2 weeks of travel, we'll turn right. And then we'll get to dry land. And they create a navigational plan. Now fast forward 2 weeks later. That captain and his sailors are caught in a blinding gale storm. You've seen them in the movies. Sheets of water wrapping across the deck. Sailors sliding to and fro, men overboard, fog, no moon, fear, panic. You can't make a decision then. You barely see 2 feet in front of them. They look back at their log and they say, well, this is what we should be doing right now. We should be turning the rudder 3 degrees left. What do you mean you can't see 2 feet in front of you? It's a blinding storm. It's dark outside. How do you know turning 3 feet left is going to rescue you in a short dry land? Yeah, but this is what we decide in the lighthouse. And it doesn't make sense now. But it made sense then. And here's the catch. Let's trust our former selves, not our current selves. Let's rely on decisions we made then, because we trust who we were then, rather than the confusion that's setting in right now. Let's stick to it blindly, even though we can't justify it. You know, it scares us, it terrifies us, and it seems counterproductive, because we made a decision. And that decision was achieved at a moment of clarity, when we saw things clearly and unobstructedly. And now let's follow through. And that's the lighthouse effect. And it's absolutely crucial in life. Because in life you have these moments of clarity where you see things better and clearer than you've seen them in the past. And you render decisions. And then life sets in. And life is confusing. And life is taxing. And life is overbearing. And you're just basically treading water to keep your head afloat. And if you make decisions on the fly, more often than not, they're passive decisions that are coerced by circumstance rather than driven by ideals and conviction. You just respond. You're responding to keep yourself going. And if you want to be an idealist, you have to have the strength of character and the conviction to stick to your guns and the courage to say, I made the decision, I'm going ahead with it, even though right now, my knees are shaking. Right now, I'm stuck in this gale storm, and I have no clue. But I trust my former self to take us to dry land, not my current self, but my current self is blind. And I can't trust my current self. It takes maturity. It takes a lot of maturity of self and of identity to be able to reach back into your past snatch a decision that you know is a superior decision and implement it in a state in which you don't think it's so superior. And this is precisely Yaakov's decision. I know I could sing Shira, and I know that I could have another Nevuah, and I can thank Hashem, but who knows what's going to happen down the road. So I am obligating myself to return to this mount. I don't know what will happen to me, but right now there's a contract. I'm obligating myself. I'm coming back to this mountain, regardless of whether, when I make the decision to come back, I see it as the right decision. I owe Hashem. I owe him a 10% cut. This is my base ale. I have to return. It's exactly. Yaakov treats this moment as his lighthouse. And you know what? His plan succeeds because he does fall. Because in the beginning of the parsha, what's he dreaming about? Angels. Ladders. Shamayim. Aretz. But then life starts changing the script. And this single bachar from yeshiva who dreams of angels and ladders has four wives and 11 children and plenty of sheep and goats. And then all of a sudden, source number two, Vayi ba'is yachem hatzon, vo'asai nai, vo'ayrem b'chalom. And all of a sudden, what's he dreaming about? Sheep and goats and dollar signs and commitments and meetings and family and children and psychologists and immunizations. Because now he's no longer that freewheeling idealist that can see the whole world clearly. Now he's bogged down by life. So what does he dream about in the middle? He dreams about sheep. At that point, Hashem sends a reminder. And the reminder couldn't be more overt. Listen to Hashem's reminder. He doesn't say, Yaakov, remember the emuna you had. Yaakov, remember the faith you had. Yaakov, remember. Vayomer Eli, Malach Elokim Bachalom Yaakov, Vayomer Inei. Look at the psukim. Mash, look at Vayomer. Sa na'inecha. Or Ei kol atudim. Look at these sheeps. The sheep. Anochi ha'el, beis el. What about beis el? This is his anchor. What about beis el? Forget the sheep. Asher mashach nasham matseva. Remember your matseva. Asher nadar talisham neder. Remember your contract. Atav, kum tsei min ha'aretz hazos. V'shuv al aretz mo'atecha. Go back. And who knows if Yaakov would have been as responsive without a contract, or without a matseva, without... There's a reference point. There's a previous point. Remember that clarity? Remember that moment? Remember that commitment? Right now, you can't think about anything but sheep. Not just sheep, but spotted sheep or dotted sheep or plain sheep. Remember who you were 20 years ago. Remember the decisions you made then. Now it's time to act on them. And right now, there are a million different excuses to justify why you shouldn't return to Eretz Yisrael. You have four wives and father-in-law and sheep and children and plenty of reasons. But you say you come back. So you want yeshiva to be successful? You have this a good shear for now because it's the middle of the year, but it's an even better shear to listen to for the Americans June 10th. Boys come home and say, what should I leave yeshiva with? Yeah. Part of the time they say, I have to leave yeshiva with pictures. Yeah, sounds strange. What do you mean? This is a sophisticated yeshiva with ideas. We don't have pictures. No pictures. Pictures of the three people or the two people that morally compelled you, that you found their Avodas Hashem, their model, role model, their Rebbe. I can recommend more. Their role model is very, seriously. Come to my room at night, the room that I spend hours and hours, I've got six pictures. I've got a picture of Amital, a picture of Aaron, a picture of the Rav, and then I've got my family, rabbinic personalities really influenced me. So when I feel weak, I look at them and say, you know what? Snap out of it. Stop it. When I feel distracted, snap out of it. When I feel... These pictures are very compelling, very graphic. Which picture is going to be up on your wall, in your study? Doesn't have to be someone you've met, someone you've read about. If you feel the Rav was so, put up a picture of Luchasi. I'm sure you've become so saturated with ideas and stories and values. You need anchors. You need concrete triggers, not just thoughts and ideas. Thoughts and ideas are very abstract, they're important, but they get lost in the heat of the moment. you know what else you have to walk out with? You have to walk out. You have to, after a year in yeshiva, a successful year, 2 years. This is going to be my commitment. I will commit to and then stick to it even when the excuses pile up. By the way, it's great advice for life, not just for religious life. It's great advice for life. It's about discipline and focus and commitment and stick-to-itiveness. Let me give you two examples from my own personal life, just to make it real for you. Because you're not at that stage yet. I sat in this room, right there, in 1985. Two phenomenal years. I was around your age, my first 2 years in yeshiva. And I knew there was more. There was more for me in this yeshiva. I left after 2 years. People say, why did you stay 3 years? To be honest, it was pikuach nefesh. We didn't have food, we didn't have water, we didn't have heat. I felt like, I got to go back and eat. I got to go back to America and just recover. It was a more Spartan existence. Life was hard in yeshiva then. It was really hard for me. Went back, finished college in about 10 minutes. You know, it was a different era. And now it's 1987, and it's time to return because I said, I'm coming back. I know I have to come back. But now it's very different. It's 1987, and none of my friends are getting on that plane because they're all graduating college and getting married and taking jobs. Legitimate things, nothing wrong, nothing criminal. All advancing with life, and I'm the only one. And I walked into that plane with my knees shaking, with butterflies in my stomach. And I get on the plane with all my friends and go on this uncertain social situation where I'm going to be, you know. I was very conscious that I made that decision in 1985. I'm going to implement it in 1987, even though the 1987 me isn't so on board, because I trusted the 1985 me more than I trusted. The 1987 was a part of the college and tests and pressures, and it's a hard 2 years. Like, college is hard. So here I was in 1987, me is saying, I'm trusting the lighthouse in me. Not the me at storm and at sea. Best 2 years of my life. Now fast forward, 1987, we have two more years, now it's 1989, and great years. So, you know, this is going to work. I want to make Aliyah, I want to live here with my family. I'm going to go back to America, make some money, squirrel some funds away, come back when I can. That's 4 years later, 1993, and life has set in. Now I'm married, now I have two children. My parents are, as they should be, very attached to my grandchildren. I've got careers, career options, and here wazoo, starting to blossom in front of me, easy solutions. It's even tougher. This is the next level of difficulty, to take my children and my wife and move with finality and give up professional and give up. What made me do it? It seemed ridiculous. People came over, this was before Nefesh B'Nefesh. People came over to my parents in shul, said, don't worry, you still have two sons. Don't worry. Like Chas V'Shalom, like they were at an Elville's house. Don't worry, you still have two other sons. Maybe they'll turn out all right. Falling off the face of it, we had internet, we had phones. Nothing. Portable phones, internet, zero. I said, well, the 1989 me thought that this was a good choice. And just because I spent 4 years at sea in blinding conditions trying to make my way and navigate, I'm going to turn the rudder left a little bit and I know I'll get to a place that I need to be at because the clearer version of me saw it. In life, it's important to have that dialogue, even without decision making, to live in the past, to be in touch with your past. So often we just go through life and we forget who we were, we forget what we thought. As you get older, I'm struggling to hold on to my past, hold on to the wisdoms of my past, the thoughts. We feel that life is evolutionary. And as you grow older and more wise and more experienced, no, there are truths and wisdoms of your past that sometimes get frayed and sometimes get effaced as you go on. Some of you may have read literature. I don't know how it came to my mind. Right? I saw today in Papa Melach, they had a very interesting Facebook post that they started a book club with one of the local Arab workers. It's very literarily oriented. So there's a book club between him and someone else, and they read the best classics, and someone came today, they're excited to see him. Some of you may have read the poetry of William Blake. William Blake was a late 19th century poet, English poet. And he wrote songs of innocence and experience, describing experiences that people go through when they're already experienced and wise, and contrasting them with experiences you go through when you're innocent, when you're young. And you think, oh, you're innocent, you're naive, that's just a setup for the deeper truths that emerge as we're experiencing. The answer is no. There's some truths that we have this Yaakov Ishtam, Yosheva Holiness, and we're more innocent to life. Right? Think about all the innocence you've lost in life. Are there points of life and innocent moments that you'd like to go back to? When you were more innocent, when you were more pure, when you saw things in a certain way that you no longer see them that way. It's important in life to be connected to your past experience, not just to thrust headlong into your future, but certainly with decisions, certainly with moral decisions, certainly with religious decisions. You have to be able to lock, and if you don't lock it in, you're just being tossed by the waves of your world. And when it's hard to go, when it's hard to perform, and it's hard to keep halacha, and it's hard to go to minyan, it's hard to learn, and the bold, great decisions in life are taken by people who just jump and leap forward, frightened, closing their eyes, but with deep conviction in their heart. And they say, I'm making this decision, I'm going to stick to it, I'm going to pursue it, and nothing will detain me, and nothing. I speak to so many people. I spoke to someone earlier this week who visited yeshiva, one of the parents who was visiting yeshiva, and he says he's on his second daf yomi, and like it was a dare, and he jumped into the daf yomi world, not knowing whether he'd be capable of it, and he thought it was the most crazy, and now he's making his second siyum, and people move to Israel, or people make other broad, brave and courageous decisions of Avodas Hashem. But I think you all feel that this mountain is giving you clarity, this mountain, this distance, walking away a little from the culture, walking away from being a high school kid, walking away from, and all of a sudden you're seeing things, so lock it in. For some of you, that will mean Shanabet. I don't know, I'm sure you're starting to talk about Shanabet. We're not going to pressure you, no one's going to indoctrinate you. I'm sure there are parts of you that say, you know what, this makes sense. I really want to grow more. And then all of a sudden, the doubt and the butterflies and the uncertainty. I can tell you how many nights I spent walking around the campus of Yeshiva, literally around this circle. It seems ridiculous now. Should I stay Shanabet? Should I not stay Shanabet? Should I stay Shanabet? I'm working on Shana Lamaches or something. Stay Shanabet, not stay Shanabet, stay Shanabet. But I was a kid, like you are, and to me that was a really, I remember at one point I just looked at Hashem and I said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm staying Shanabet, that's going to be my Akedah. And to me it felt that way. But at some point I felt, this is right, and I'm going to force myself into it, and I'll make it work. I'll make the decision work. Rather than wondering and questioning the decision, again, it's not a Shanabet pitch, I'm sure you guys all have personal and but decisions are decisions, and you can't just make a decision on the spur of the moment. It's like walking to an ice cream store. No, vanilla and chocolate. What do I feel like right now? Strawberries. You're not picking flavors. Decision making isn't just whim of the moment, isn't caprice. It's thought, it's values, it's evaluation of different factors, and it's also what did I think at earlier stages about this decision? If it made sense then, let me return back because right now it's a little too confused. So that's why Yaakov lacks it in with the contract. And fortunately for him, we talked about how he gets lost in sheep. By the end of the parasha, look at the last section, first section, last paragraph. By Yaakov halach ledarko, by yifku bo malachei elokim. So now once again, he's dreaming about angels. This is a very nice, neat parasha. It starts with dreams about angels. It ends with, it's not clear whether it's dreams or rendezvous with angels, with malachim. But in the middle, he gets a little sidetracked. In the middle, he gets too immersed in sheep and goats and spots and blotches. And it's only that Beit El contract that wakes him up and draws him out. So that's tonight's major, major idea. We like to hit upon one major idea every parsha. Remember Chayesara, work-life balance, Toldos, last week's parsha, Toldos. Remember Toldos, revolution, post-revolutionary people just have boring lives and just lock in there. But Yetzeh, lighthouse. Moments of clarity, lock it in. It's going to come for you guys in about 5 or 6 months. Walk out of this yeshiva with two clear-cut decisions of Avodas Hashem that you saw clear to be simple ones. Like, oh, I'm not going to talk in davening anymore. That doesn't make sense. Never thought of it, but it just doesn't make sense to talk in davening. I'm going to go to davening, or I'm going to be more makbid on this halacha. I'm going to be larger ones. I'm going to move. I'm going to whatever. But there has to be something, or else this yeshiva will be a teva. And you'd be surprised how quickly after you leave the teva, it could all fall apart. And if you don't believe me, look at Noach. How could you? What were you thinking? If you don't believe me, look at Am Yisrael and the Egel. As much as you have these religious highs, they can disappear very quickly. It's human nature. Human nature is very, very fluid. Very dynamic. It can change on a dime. Commitments don't. On that note, Let's talk about the 14 hidden years. Where was Yaakov for the 14 hidden years? A quick calculation of his life, there are 14 missing years. So we all know, we all heard this story. I don't have to tell you where he was. I'll just highlight one word describing where he was and let you think about how that should affect your yeshiva experience. Okay? Source number, Dalet. We'll skip the source, Dalet. Vayishkav b'makom ahu. He slept in that place. Why is there such an emphasis? He slept in that place, b'makom ahu. Vayishkav b'makom ahu. So, the Medrash infers from this. Vayishkav b'makom ahu. Rabbi Yehuda of Rebbe Nechemiah. Rabbi Yehuda Amar Kan Shachav. He slept this night. Avol kol yud dalet shana shahayab tamun beveis ever lo shachav. For 14 years he didn't sleep. Now, don't take this medrash literally. He can't not sleep for 14 years. But for 14 years he wasn't sleeping leisurely. He wasn't relaxed. He was pushing himself. Basically, he got to Har Moriah. He was exhausted. He just collapsed. He plots and he fell asleep. Vayishkav b'makom ahu. Kan shachav. Kol yud dalet shana shahayab yeshiva shein ve'ever lo shachav. But what word does the Medrash use to describe his time in Yeshiva Shein Ve'ever? Anyone see that word?
Tamun.
Anyone know what the word Tamun means? What?
Insulated.
A little bit more than insulated?
Hidden.
Hidden. What does it mean he was hidden in Yeshiva Shein Ve'ever? Well, let me ask you a different question. If his experience in Shein Ve'ever is so important and so formative, as we know it is, why doesn't the Torah record it? Answer, because for 14 years he was hidden. And that hiddenness is being conveyed textually. We don't see it. Because for 14 years no one saw him. So we, the listeners, the audience, the outside world, don't see him. Because for 14 years he was insulated, immersed in the world. He was Tamun. So the style here reflects the content. For 14 years he was Tamun, and the style is, well, we're not going to talk about it. It's beneath the surface, because he was off the grid. This is a really important question, guys. This is not a yeshiva of demonizing. Sometimes I wish we were. It's a little bit easier to say everything outside of these walls is meaningless, is a waste of your time, and is a criminal act that diverts you away from your learning. Well, I said before, that's not our view of life. But, and I talked about this in the Old City, you have to shave in yeshiva. I don't mean you have to shave your beard. In order for you to be successful, you have to shave away some of your experiences. You can't carry it all through. It can't be a balanced, normal. That is the kiss of death. If you expect every part of your life to just continue naturally, friends, culture, internet, yoga class, calisthenics, parties, get together, then it'll be deflated. It'll just be limp. It'll just be a dull experience. She's meant to be intense. It's meant to be focused. It's meant to be directed. If I would have to liken it to something, again, I say this as a way of creating extremism, and extremism always creates clarity, black and white, think of it as a boot camp. The conditions of boot camp aren't normal. In a boot camp, you have to ask your officer to breathe sometimes, to scratch your eye, to scratch your nose, to go to the bathroom. Is that the way we lead our lives? Of course not. But what value, and one value is being attained and achieved in boot camp. One value. Give me the word. What's the one value in boot camp?
Discipline.
You don't ask any questions. You completely submit your freedom of choice, because if in the time of war where the bullets are flying and the guns are blazing and explosions are making you crazy and disoriented, everyone's thinking, should I go left, should I go right, should I take this? The officer issues a command, you follow blindly, immediately, discipline, else the army falls apart. Army discombobulates. So sometimes in life you shave away reality in order to heighten and deepen a particular trait. So borrowing from that metaphor, yeshiva is not just a lighthouse, but it's also a boot camp. To shave away a little so that passion and commitment and a relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu
that all these can start to flower and grow. And I can't tell you what to shave and what not to shave. But you can't view shaving as, what do you mean? It's not realistic. It's unhealthy. I told you I've got these pet peeves, these words I just can't stand when people talk about yeshiva. Gap year. It kills me. Let's get on with life. Okay, you want to call it that way, but call it like gap year. Unfortunately, life demands from us professional advancement. One day, Gan Eden will look very much like yeshiva. No jobs, no wars, no cancer, no money. They won't just be thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, studying Torah. All of us very much like yeshiva. So you want to say, let's get on with our fleeting, ephemeral world at the cost of walking away from the one taste which represents our eternal world. That's not a good phrase, a gap year, but a hard phrase for me. Another hard phrase. I'm worried in yeshiva my son's going to burn out. Don't get me wrong, there's a danger of burnout. But most boys that walk through these doors are in no danger. Most boys. No one's in danger of burnout. A person has no horizons, no hobbies, no extracurricular interests, no friends, and no psychological stability. Every one of you comes from a patchwork of different experiences, sports and clubs and friends and camps, and you have the emotional resources. And that great fear of burnout, we're so worried about burnout, we never even start to burn. Because we're so worried about burnout, so there's no flame because we're afraid of the conflagration. So I don't know, boys have asked me very often, like on interviews, and I try to be as honest, not recruiting on interviews. Okay, I take exercise, or there's once a boy who was here who was very into fencing. He would go to Yishalayim every week to continue his fencing lessons because we had spoken. He was an honest boy. That fencing was a language for him. And be like telling someone not to speak English for a whole year or not to speak your language. So some things are so deeply part of you, they're your language. Working out for many of you is your language. You just don't feel good physically and emotionally without working out, without jogging. In most cases, I think you should. Overwhelming in most cases. It's hard for me to even imagine a case of a boy who wants to work out. Again, if you feel that, I could just put it on hold for a couple months and just dedicate that time to Talmud Torah and I'll come back to it later. Then that's a legitimate choice also. But I think every one of you now should think, what am I prepared to shave from my life right now? TV? What favorite series that you watch, and you watch outside of yeshiva, and you're so insistent upon maintaining, shave it off and just take those voices outside of your head. Take those actors and actresses and themes and put them outside of your head so that your head could be full of ketzos and davening and halacha and avos and imos. Make room for Yaakov and Yitzchak and less room for whatever shows you're watching, whatever athletes you're following. Or friends. Just instead of religiously having to attend friends, get together and go out, now's the time. If it doesn't start to click now within... I know all of you are doing beautifully. No one is falling off the grid. Again, I don't know everyone's schedule, but there are enough checks and balances that we put in place here to make sure that you're coming and you're attending and you're in the base matter. Anyone who's not reaching that threshold at some point is going to face our intervention in a healthy way, not because we're going to punish you or discriminate against you. It's not a place for people who are holding the group back. Everyone's trying to be part of it and grow. Again, largely described. No one's going to count your minutes, and no one's going to challenge whether you need to take a break here or there. But people simply cannot participate and not show up. This is not a good environment for you, and you're not a good participant in what we're trying to create. But beyond that, how much you're integrating and assimilating and the passion and the intensity and the focus, it's very, very hard to legislate. It's impossible. We can encourage you. We can inspire you. You can't say, oh, you're not passionate enough. You have to leave yeshiva. You're not focused. You're not shaving enough, you believe. You don't shave physically. You leave yeshiva. But emotionally and existentially. And part of it is this really fascinating medrash. Read the next medrash. Vayikatz Yaakov Mishnasa. He wakes up from his sleep. So Chazal say, Al Tikri Mishnasa, or the other one, Mishnasa. He woke up from his learning. Not Mishenasa from his sleep, but Mishnasa. And let me ask you something. Was he learning or was he sleeping? He can't be both. What does this medrash mean? Vayikatz Yaakov Mishnasa or Mishnasa? Was he learning or was he sleeping? The answer? This is a strange answer, but I want you to listen carefully. It's really, really important. At a certain point, when you're so focused and intense, you're learning when you're sleeping. Now, what does that mean, you're learning when you're sleeping? And what's Rabbi Darrigan talking about? This is really spooky. Learning when you're sleeping? What do you dream about? You dream about the issues that are on your heart. That's for sure. It's disoriented, it's unfocused, it's vague, it's complex, it's not incoherent, but it's clear when you dream, you're able to trace it to something. Parents, future, desires, whatever. I'm not going to dream tonight about Bolivia. Probably dream about Bolivia because we mentioned Bolivia. But I didn't mention Bolivia. It's not on my mind. Now it is on my mind. It's about dreaming about Bolivian coffee. It's a guy with a cigar speaking in some, you know, swag South American accent. But probably won't dream about Bolivia. Things that are on your mind, you dream about. Well, here's a good indicator. If you dream Torah, then it's a good sign that you're really internalizing it. If you're at that point where all of a sudden it comes out in your dreams, Tzadok HaKohen Milublin, dream sugyos, and dream midrashim, and he got up and he wrote a sefer called Kuntres Divrei Chalamos. He actually wrote it down. There's a sefer called Shelos V'Tshuvos Min HaShamayim by a son of the Rush about his dreams going to Shemayim, but that sounds like it's more Kabbalah. He didn't dream, he actually went to Shemayim and asked questions. There's a whole bunch of tshuvos that he received in Shemayim. We don't postulate most of the answers, actually. So it's not going to happen every night, but I'll tell you how it can happen. I'll give you two bits of advice. First of all, I mean, nothing to do with the dreams. Try going to sleep from Torah. Try learning, reading, and then just going to sleep. And you'll find at some level you'll wake up in the morning different. I can't explain it to you, but you'll wake up different. Because you went to sleep within Torah, and you then woke up. And it's hard because this is the natural way to put yourself to sleep, to look at the news. And I do it sometimes also. Look at the news and Google and Facebook. And try it one night. Try one night, just be whatever you do, whatever you want to read, and whatever Google, whatever surfing, whatever. And then stop. Half an hour, Mishnayos, Kriya Shema with Kavana, Shema with Kavana, Rigzu V'el Techato. I can't explain it to you, but that 6 hours or 5 hours or 7 hours that you're in Shemayim, you just, obviously you're alive, right? You're not dead during those 7 hours. Your conscience is suppressed, but your identity is alive in ways that I can't describe to you because I'm conscious. But you're in Shemayim. So you walk up to Shemayim, what are you talking to Kodesh Baruch Hu about? Facebook friends post, and your Instagram post, and the game, or the Mishnah you read. I can promise you something's happening in Shemayim. I can promise you it's a different experience. I remember once interviewing a boy for yeshiva, and he said, Rabbi, is it true that guys in Gush learn in their pajamas? You know, all these like strange canards and strange stigmas. It's bad enough the stigmas that are wrong, but at least make sense. What about the stigmas that are wrong and don't make sense? I said, well, isn't that good that people learn in their pajamas? Like, one day I want you to learn in your pajamas. Like, just listen to what you're saying. Don't you want to, like, learn in your pajamas? Like, isn't that beautiful? You go to sleep, you have a sefer, you learn, you close your eyes, you go to Shemayim. No, it's a really good point. He came to Gush State 3 years. He's a Rebbe now. I'm not going to tell you who his name is, but some of you know him. Like, the pajama warrior. He's a big Rebbe somewhere. Probably because he learns in his pajamas. And part of that is not just how hard you work and how hard you internalize, but you can take this carefully and responsibly, but also pushing your sleep patterns. Yaakov, look at me, didn't sleep for 14 years. Come on, he slept. But he didn't relax. He didn't get up late. He didn't toss around the bed. He was up, and he pushed, and he pushed, and he pushed. Kan shachav, call your dalat shana shavishir shem beiva lo shachav, and that's why the learning. It's strange, but I can tell that sometimes I drift because I'm exhausted, and I daydream because I'm exhausted. And when I'm on plane, sometimes I allow myself to daydream because I know that's a way for me to think. It's not cognitive. And some of the ideas that I daydream about of Torah that are not coherent, but I know that they affect the Torah learning. After they open certain ideas, that I can't achieve purely through cerebral cognitive activity. I know that I'm seeing certain things. They're not cogent, they're not words, but they're ideas, thoughts, whims. When I close my eyes and I drift, I know when I'm drifting from Torah, I feel that I'm drifting in Torah. So I can't tell you, it's like Yaakov, and I just feel like I'm uncovering certain things, I'm reaching certain truths, now that my mind is laid to rest, that my subconscious is trying to reach. So that's something, now's the time to think. I remember right around now, it was mid-November, a little bit before now, right around now, an older boy came over to me and said, do you learn during the break? I said, learn during the break? Are you crazy? I eat 120, whatever I can, get my hands on, run back, hug my pillow for dear life, and wake up at 3 o'clock if I'm lucky. He said, no, you can learn during the break. I said, come on, you're crazy. Learn during the break, you're crazy. And I tried it. And you know what? I learned during the break. Some days yes, some days not. And I learned past whatever night Seder ending was. We didn't have such rules and guidelines, but I had late night chavrusas. Very, very exciting late night chavrusas. And here's the interesting part. I learned sometimes Friday afternoon when I was in yeshiva. And I got a lot from that. I learned Masa Shabbos sometimes when I was in yeshiva. And I even learned on Shabbos sometimes when I was in yeshiva. So here's my request to you. Don't create no Torah results. No one's going to be marking you and charting you. You learn during the break? Okay, X, check. You don't learn during the break? I just gave you five slots that could be meaningful slots. And don't just simply toss them. Or not. If you feel like you're still struggling to turn the primary slots into meaningful slots and you need that time for recovery and relaxation, then use it that way. One's got to find the mountain that they're currently climbing. Don't climb someone else's mountain. Climb your own mountain. Find your own challenges. But if you've already locked in those three sessions, morning, afternoon, night, and davening, and you're humming, and you're in this routine, and say, well, maybe I should learn during the break. About 70 people that learned during the break. Again, I haven't been here during the break in a while, but over the last 30 years, I can just tell you, the average, when I'm here during the break, it's hard to see because it's a big base match. But go around tomorrow. Just come during the break at 2 o'clock and count how many people. You'd be surprised. I'm sure it's over 40. Not 70, but it's over 40. So there are 40 people who are not just saying, it's the break, I'm going to toss it. Weather's cold. You may not be wanting to play sports as much anymore. You know, at least as a team, though, you want to be jogging and other things, but those are things you can do on your own. Think about that and think about how that will help you. Think about what you want to shave and think about how you want to press your schedule. Shaving and pressing your schedule will help you convert yeshiva from classes, books, courses, and schedules to what we're really looking for, growth and identity. That's the bridge you have to cross. If you just show up, your books, your courses, your pens, the information, you can play it out, but I know where this is heading. I've been here too long. I know where this is heading. I can't tell you this is going to be such a big carryover. If it's identity and growth and thought and pushing, then it will carry over. The way to reach that is shaving, each person their own, and pushing the schedule. Those are two good tactics right now to put yourself into an emotional space. Even if you're not there yet, I promise you, if you work hard at it for a couple of weeks, you'll find yourself arriving at an emotional place that you couldn't have achieved beforehand. Okay, let's stop now. Oh, sorry. 2 minutes.